I want to welcome all of the participants who are signed on to another meeting of the First Friday Breakfast Club, an association of gay, bisexual, and transgendered men, and the largest private breakfast club in the state of Iowa. We've been going strong now for just coming up on 25 years. And one of the outstanding things that this club has done is to give scholarships to Iowa high school students who have done impressive, courageous things to reduce homophobia and educate about LGBTQ issues in their schools and communities. To date, we have raised right at $400,000 in scholarship money for that scholarship program. I want to thank David Cotton, who is hosting our Zoom meeting today. It appears that we're getting better and better at figuring this out. And a number of us are of a certain age. So we are challenged, some of us more than others, with this technology. But we are having more attendees, more participants at each of our meetings since we have been virtual. I have a number of announcements that I want to touch upon before we move on to our speaker. A couple of regular things that I call out. If any of you shops on Amazon for anything, if you sign up with smile.amazon.com, you can designate the First Friday Breakfast Club, and Amazon will make a contribution to First Friday Breakfast Club. It won't cost you anything. It is just a contribution that they make to anyone who signs up on smile.amazon.com and designates First Friday Breakfast Club. So it's like found money, and encourage you to do that if you are an Amazon shopper. Also, if your company is pushing you to contribute to the United Way, you are certainly encouraged to do that. And many employers really put on full court press to have people sign up for contributions to United Way. You can designate First Friday Breakfast Club to receive all or a portion of your contribution to United Way. It is fully tax deductible. We're not funded by United Way, but we are a permitted designee under their donor direct program. If you just go to the bottom of the sign up sheet, you can designate First Friday Breakfast Club. United Way will take out a small percentage of your contribution, and the rest comes to us as a contribution to help keep our budget balanced. We have a few announcements. One I want to call to your attention on October the 9th, the Des Moines Pastoral Counseling Center is sponsoring an online virtual meeting to address the subject of mental health for men and boys. And if any of you would be interested in participating, I think it is without any charge. In fact, I know it's without charge. If you are interested and would let me know, I'd be happy to get you the information. Or if you can contact Doug Alperl, he has the information for you to be able to participate. Let's see. Next, our board of directors will be meeting next Tuesday, 6:30. That will also be virtual. Any member is welcome to participate in that meeting. Just let me know, we'll get you the information necessary to participate in that board meeting. I also wanted to let everybody know that the board has been involved in a leadership transition process, we're looking at transitioning. In fact, we've been learning some from our virtual meetings that we can do lots more with data online and streamline our meeting notices. And we're also looking into the potential that when we are meeting in person again, that we may be able to utilize some facilities that the Hoyt Sherman Place has for broadcasting our speaker in addition to the in-person meeting. So that those who are not able to come to that meeting or can't get up in time to come to that meeting, they can still last minute sign on and hear the speaker. There are issues of confidentiality that we'll need to address and have protocols in place so that people who might be sensitive about it won't appear on camera with what's being broadcast. But it's something that we are looking into, as well as the leadership transition. I've been president of FFBC now for right at a quarter of a century, and there comes a time when baton needs to be passed along, and so we're working through what that looks like. At this point, we're going to be proposing at our next meeting the slate of candidates for election to our board of directors. That election will take place in January. I also can say that Wade Peterson has been our production editor for the newsletter and has agreed going forward that he will be the editor, both editor and production editor of the newsletter. I will continue to corral articles and copy material for the newsletter, but Wade will be doing the editing, both the editing and the production editing as well. Are there any other announcements that need to be made?
Hi there, everyone. It's Nate Munson with Iowa Safe Schools. And first, let me say, Jonathan, you've done a fantastic job for First Friday Breakfast Club and the whole queer community. So congratulations on your retirement, I guess we call it. And you've done a great work and laid a great foundation. So we all appreciate that. And just quickly, Iowa Safe Schools is hosting our Spirit Awards on October 22nd. It helps benefit all of our great work we do for the organization supporting LGBTQ youth. So it's going to be virtual. We have meals from Bubba. I'm going to put the link in the chat, but First Friday came last year. We'd love to have you all again. And for silent auction items, my mom made a rainbow quilt, and I grabbed it real quick because I just have to, you know, she told me I have to plug it on everything. So rainbow quilt's available. But really, we appreciate everything you all do and supporting all the students. So I'll put the link in the chat.
Perfect. That's great. And if you'll send that to me as well, Nate, I'll see that it gets sent out to the full group, which is somewhere between 450 and 500. So if you'll get that to us, we'll circulate it as well.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Sure. Any other announcements? Hearing none, I'm going to turn to Wade Peterson to introduce our speaker this morning. Wade?
Thanks, Jonathan. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker this morning, the Auditor of the State of Iowa, Rob Sand. Rob was born and raised in Decorah, Iowa, where his first job was catching chickens. His favorite childhood memories are of fishing, biking, and camping. After high school, Rob attended and graduated from Brown University, and after college, Rob returned to Iowa to attend Iowa Law School on a full merit scholarship. Rob Sand was named an assistant attorney general in September 2010 and spent much of his first 18 months investigating and prosecuting tax credit fraud related to Iowa's filmmaking tax credit program. Then Rob was recruited to Area Prosecutions, a small group of prosecutors who take on many of the state's toughest cases. There, he became the youngest prosecutor in the division and Iowa's first ever assistant attorney general focused on prosecuting financial crime. In the 2008 elections, Rob successfully ran for Iowa State Auditor as a Democrat and was sworn into office on January 2, 2019. The office's mission is to serve as a taxpayer's watchdog by ensuring that government officials use taxpayer dollars for the intended purposes to benefit the public. Rob and his wife, also a small-town Iowa native, have two sons. Today, he still hunts, fishes, and bikes regularly. In fact, the Iowa Bow Hunters Association has certified him as an expert bow hunter. So I'm sure he'll hit a bullseye with us this morning. So we'd like to welcome Rob Sand.
Thank you very much, Wade, for the introduction. I appreciate that. And it's nice to be here with all of you this morning. I don't know what's going to happen here because it's 7 a.m. We have a new puppy and a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old in our house. So I'm going to try to be focused on you. The door, to the room I'm in, the doors to the room I'm in are closed. We'll see what happens. I'm really delighted to join you though. I've known about this group for quite some time, but haven't had a chance to speak before you, at an earlier time. And so I'm happy to be here, even if it's, you know, virtually. I'm sure you, like me, have been doing quite a few Zoom meetings, and I tend to think they are not quite the same or even close to being in the same room as people, but they are a whole lot better than a phone call. So it's nice to be able to at least see a few other folks on there and sometimes get some feedback on how I'm doing and if my jokes are landing okay. It's also nice to see some familiar faces out there. Hi to Ryan, hi to Nate. I can't remember who else was out there. I think there was somebody that I attend church with at Plymouth, at the UCC church here in Des Moines. But regardless, hi to all of you this morning. I am very open to addressing whatever you all want to address this morning. My plan is to sort of give everyone a little bit of a rundown of what we do in the auditor's office, but also my decision to run for it. And then I'll plan to leave a lot of time for question and answer. If your questions are not about the auditor's office, that is fine. I just like to talk to people. So I hope you bring some questions and plan to talk to me. So I was in the Attorney General's office, as the introduction noted, since 2010, and mostly working on financial crime. And that was actually how I got to know the auditor's office, because the auditor's office, one of their responsibilities is to conduct most of the investigations into financial crime in Iowa. And so if someone has stolen public funds in the state of Iowa, the auditor's office is going to be involved in conducting the investigation. I worked with people who worked in the auditor's office, got to know them, got to know their passion for the job. Noticed a few things that I thought could use changing, but I was enjoying the work that I was doing in the Attorney General's office. Film office tax credit, the lottery rigging scandal, those were all cases that I had prosecuted. But another piece of my responsibilities at the office was sort of being backup for SVP cases, sexually violent predator. And these are cases where we are trying to keep the absolute worst of the worst sexual offenders in the state in a secure facility past the end of their prison sentence because they're very much expected to reoffend. They're very dark cases, very disturbing cases. And I have always been, and I've always described myself as a happy and optimistic person. And the thing is, the mix of the work that I was doing with SVP cases, but also with financial cases and some violent crime as well, I prosecuted, robbery, murder, attempted murder, bank robbery, perjury, oddly enough. At the end of the day, criminal justice system is not a happy place. You wake up every day as a prosecutor thinking only about the worst things that people can do to each other. And that's what you think about all day in your job. And it can wear on you. So I was introducing myself to someone or describing myself probably 6 years into the job. And I remember saying, I specifically remember the moment I said, I'm a happy, optimistic person because that's how I've always described myself. And the words came out of my mouth and I sounded to myself, not happy, not optimistic. And it just struck me. I felt very different saying that than I had ever felt saying it prior. And it really made me reflect upon what I was doing in my life and where I wanted to go. At that point, we had one son. We have two. Tate is 6 and Axel's 4. And I like optimism. I like being happy. I'm built that way. And I didn't want to continue working in a job that I knew was slowly going to just sort of harden me to everything, and where I had few opportunities to do something positive. I had gotten my interest in public service from growing up in Decorah. My parents are very, very public service oriented, consistent volunteers and community organizations. I think it's a big piece of our family's faith and the way we approach our faith. And so I knew I wanted to be doing public service, but I wanted to be doing something positive where I could actually help make things better in our state and in our communities rather than just sort of, as you do in criminal prosecution, mitigate bad things and make them less bad. And so I started thinking about this and considered the work that I could do at the auditor's office. Well, that's an office that I'd be qualified for because I have done a lot of the same work that they do. And one of the things I had noticed was they really could use some professional law enforcement experience in the office. The reason I had noticed that is there had been a number of investigations that had been conducted where the folks did a good job, but they were all accountants and CPAs in the office. Which the analogy I've always used is it's like having 11 quarterbacks playing on your offense all at the same time. They might be very talented and very good players, but you don't have a network or a team with different skill sets working together to get a good outcome. And if you're conducting law enforcement investigations that are going to go into a courtroom with no one on staff with law enforcement experience, you are occasionally going to make significant mistakes. You won't even know that you made them. And so that was an issue. That was something that was important that I thought, well, if I ran for the office, I could fix that. It also seemed a little small to me to just have one thing that I wanted to do. And so I have always been rather studious. I sat down and I read the job description of the state auditor. That's chapter 11 of the Iowa Code. That's really, at the end of the day, the source of all of the authority that the office has, the source of all of the impact that the office can have. It's in the law. Doesn't matter what you read somewhere else. At the end of the day, what's the law? And so I read that 3 times. And what I saw, it actually really excited me about the job. I knew they did financial audits. I knew they did the investigative work. But there's this other piece of their authority that's incredibly broad and incredibly positive and potentially impactful. And that is the idea that the office can always, as a part of its work, make efficiency recommendations. The office can have entities reviewed not just for whether or not the accounts are presenting correctly, not just for whether or not there's fraud, but also are they doing their job in the most efficient way? Are there ideas for things that public entity could do to do their job more efficiently? And that got me excited. I have always been someone who's very excited about the idea or appreciative of the idea of efficiency. I hate waste, primarily. It's maybe more of an aversion to wasting things. And I'm also just a believer in good government. To me, the question is government is less about the size of it and more about is it doing a good job at what it needs to do? Not big, not small, but is it good versus bad? And I'm a big believer in good government because it's ours. We ought to have a government that we're proud of. At the end of the day, no one else is responsible for it but us. And so the idea that here was this job, this office, that could do its investigations differently, but that also had this really broad mandate to get into issues of efficiency and good government that it didn't really use. Easy decision from that point, because that was something that was very exciting to me. If I ran and I won, I didn't need to get the legislature to change the law. I didn't need to convince anyone else to do it with me. I could simply do positive work by getting the auditor's office to start doing efficiency promotion and by adding law enforcement professionals to the office and change the office's culture and its impact on the state of Iowa in a way that could be very positive for the state. And so suddenly I was excited again and decided to run. Enjoyed the campaign, and started the job, got sworn in January 2019. And we've started our efficiency program. It's called PIE, Public Innovations and Efficiencies. We chose that name because it spells PIE. We think that the program should be as popular as PIE. Who is against efficiency in government? Who wants to see more waste, fraud, and abuse in government? Hopefully nobody. And it's pretty simple program. There's three pieces to PIE. First, we have our PIE chart. That's a 5-page checklist of very basic efficiency practices. Some of them will save you money in your home. If you want to use it, you can look it up at our website. It's auditor.iowa.gov/PIE. Whether you use it in your home is up to you. That's your money you're spending. But the whole idea behind it is it's our money in the public sector, so we should note whether or not various entities are using those practices. And so we ask public entities to fill those that checklist out, the pie chart, every year. Year two, they come back, where we are able to see how many practices they've added. That allows us to have a pie contest. And the winners of our pie contest, I will very gladly travel around the state and sort of lift their hand into the air like a champion for taxpayers, and let folks in their area know that they're doing well by the people they represent. The office has always been a little bit of a poker to local entities, and I want it to be more of a partner at the same time. So for the office to not just recognize and point out bad governance when it happens, but also to point out good governance, I think is important. Like I said, I think we ought to find ways to be proud of our system of government, because at the end of the day, it just reflects us. And I think we're good people. And so we'll have a pie contest where we travel around and recognize those entities that are most improved. And then finally, we are looking for pie recipes. So anytime any public servant in the state has come up with an idea that has saved money for a public entity, like a city or a county or a school district, we want them to tell us about it. And then we can include it in the pie chart and spread that good idea all around the state. We also like to include contact information for the person who came up with the idea, because that means that nobody else has to reinvent the wheel. If they read about the idea and think, oh, that sounds good, and then halfway through they have a hiccup, they can call that person up and maybe say, hey, here's our problem. Did you have to solve this problem too? It also is a good way to give credit to the people who originate the ideas, which again, I think is very important, to give credit to those who deserve it. So the program's going really well. We've had participation from more than half of Iowa's counties in just the first year that we've gotten it set up. And we've also, to address the other campaign issue, we've added law enforcement professionals to the office. I think that's been positive for the investigative work that we've done. Two individuals, both of whom each have more than a decade of experience in law enforcement, we're now working with our accountants day in, day out to make sure that not only are our investigations sound on the numbers, but they're also sound on the law. So the work in the office in that regard, I've been able to do the things I set out to do. There have also been a couple of very much unexpected challenges. The first was the office culture. Previous management, and I'm not speaking just about my predecessor and the chair that I sit in, but previous management had been very uninterested in listening to employees, very uninterested in listening to, very uninterested in addressing their concerns. It was not a hospitable adaptive workplace. I don't know where that mindset came from particularly, but I can tell you I'm 38 years old. People who are my age and younger, particularly, want to work somewhere where they feel like they are taken seriously as a human being and that they are respected as a human being, and that if they have an issue that they will be taken seriously enough to hear it be addressed. The office has had a retention problem for years. We regularly bring in new college graduates, train them using your taxpayer resources, and then they leave to go work somewhere else where younger folks are given a more flexible work schedule or they don't have to travel as much. And so we have really worked hard to change that. We've done it in a lot of ways. The first thing I did coming in was sit down with all the employees one-on-one. Everybody had 20 minutes, just kind of get to know you and tell me how I can make your job better. And we've instituted a ton of reforms out of that. It's an initiative we call Better Workplace, Better Work. The idea is if you're in a better workplace, you're going to do better work. Pretty straightforward. And that's important because at the end of the day, our owners, the owners of our office are taxpayers and we want them to be well served. So we've modified back in 2019, we modified people's ability to work from home. We modified people's ability to work unusual hours if that was their preference. We have greatly undertaken an effort to reduce travel to make sure that people can be home more often, have more free time, be around their families more often. That's all been very positive. We also instituted something we're calling statewide work, statewide jobs. I'm sure that a lot of you out there, I saw we have somebody from Alcater, High Northeast Iowa. But I'm also sure a lot of you are from small towns around the state. And if you're like me, maybe if the right job had been there, you would have gone back. We need to be supportive of that. There is too much of an emphasis, I think, in state government in the idea that everything has to be in Des Moines. It doesn't. Our office does work in all 99 counties. And so we set up a change that we called statewide work, statewide jobs. If we're going to work all over the state of Iowa, then we should offer jobs all over the state of Iowa. It's very simple. Instead of having people travel from Des Moines and back for every audit that they might be working on, once someone has a year of experience and they've gotten to know the office and how it works, we let them live wherever they want. So we've had staff move to Henry County. We've had staff move to Clayton County. Somebody went a little ways out west, maybe Elkhorn. And we just assign them to local audits in the area that they now live. And so they don't have to spend nights in hotels. They can get home more easily. They get to be in the town they want to live in, which is important to keeping them happy. It also reduces turnover for our office, which is good for taxpayers, right? If you are in Clayton County, there is not as much competition for your work, for your skill set, as there is in Des Moines. Here in Des Moines, we got to compete with EMC Insurance, Travelers, Nationwide, Drake University, Principal Financial, you name it, right? There's a lot of people here who want to hire accountants. There's just less competition for those jobs in smaller towns. Here's the bigger piece of it, though, to me, as someone who grew up in a small town. I think it's easy to forget, and people in Des Moines might not understand, the impact that it has on a rural area or a small town when a new younger person moves to town, right? Whether they're moving single or they're bringing a family, they're bringing a job. It's similar to when you see a storefront open or close in a downtown that's five blocks long. I mean, you end up talking about that storefront closing for 3 weeks. Should we have shopped there more? The prices were a little high. Was it just because they weren't that good at business? And it really makes you wonder, what happens next? Are we going to lose another store, or will that one get filled again? And there's a sense of living and dying by the business, by the family, by the person in smaller towns. We should be trying to support people who want to contribute to positivity and to growth in small towns in Iowa. The impact that has in Des Moines is like this. If a restaurant closes in Des Moines, people say, oh, that's too bad. I hope I like the next one better. there's just an assumption that there will be something else that follows. That assumption doesn't exist outside of Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, and Ames. Cedar Falls, maybe. But once you get into smaller towns and rural areas, that assumption is not there. And so we should be supporting those smaller towns and rural areas. And so that's what we're doing with our statewide work, statewide jobs program. The other thing is pandemic-wise, you know, we've switched to work at home. We did that back in March. We've since had about 20% of our workforce say in June that they really preferred to be in the office. And so because that was only going to put us at 20% capacity, we had that 20% go back. They're all wearing masks all the time. They have to be in cubicles that at least have one buffer cubicle in between them. And, you know, we've got one-way hallways and all sorts of other safety precautions. And that's been going well so far. We've been busy with a lot of audits related to Medicaid that I'll touch on. And I don't know, I'll punch in the chat here. If you all, I don't know how you like to do questions. If you want to write them in there, you can. If you want to just ask them, unmute yourself, you can interrupt me and ask them too. But I'll give you a little bit of a summary of some of our Medicaid audits in our Test Iowa audit, and then I'll open it up for questions. With the pandemic, one thing I'm excited about is we're participating in a nationwide coronavirus data audit. What this is a lot of state auditors addressing the same questions in their states separately. So that when they all issue reports, those reports can be compared to each other fairly, and we can look around the country and hopefully see good and bad practices according to states and hopefully move things in the right direction. This is an amazing opportunity to learn. We have not had a pandemic in a time where we have had modern medical technology. Testing was not something that was available in the influenza pandemic after World War I. And so we have a lot to learn here. And we don't know if we are in the first quarter or the fourth quarter of this pandemic. You know, we don't know if in 3 weeks someone's going to announce that they have a miracle treatment, that, you know, the coronavirus is out there, but now no one will ever get as sick again. On the other hand, it could be years. We just don't know. And what that means to me is there is no time like right now to be conducting oversight of our response efforts to try to make sure that those response efforts are effective and efficient. The sooner we do that, the sooner we can learn, the sooner we can improve our response. I think that most Iowans understand that this is a challenging time because it's challenging for all of us individually. It's affecting all of us. And I don't think they expect perfection from their elected leaders, but they expect correction. It's hard to get something, all things right when you're dealing with something that is as novel as a pandemic. And yet it's also as fundamental when it's a matter of life and death to correct those things you get wrong once it's pointed out. So the sooner we can do that work, I think the better an impact we can have on the state's pandemic response. And I'm glad to be a part of this bipartisan group nationwide that's working on that. One audit that we've already conducted, I actually think we were the first auditor's office in the country to get an audit completed related to the coronavirus epidemic, was on the reporting system for results. Long story short, the reporting system for Test Iowa results, we believe, is illegal and introduces unnecessary risk into the reported system. The law requires that when a lab has a result for a reportable disease like coronavirus, it has to get sent immediately, that's the law, immediately, to the Department of Public Health. And we, as common sense might dictate the meaning of the word immediately, we went ahead and looked at some Supreme Court decisions that interpreted the word and guided our decision-making based on that. The problem is that the results are not going from the lab to the Department of Public Health. That would be immediate. Instead, they go to two of the private companies in Utah that are a part of the contract. Then they go to a different state agency. Then they go to the Department of Public Health. Why is that not immediate? Well, immediate like impossible being without possibility, or impatient being without patience. Immediate is without intermediary. And so if you are running a route like that, that's not immediate. Here's the other problem, though. We've all played that child's game of telephone, right? Where you whisper something to the person sitting next to you, and then they whisper it to somebody, and the more people you have in there, the more opportunities there are for either the message to be misheard or someone to just change the message because they're acting silly. Same thing here. If we have a long route in reporting Test Iowa results for people's pandemic, for their coronavirus tests, we're just introducing more risk that something can go wrong. When you have just one connection, there's just two places where things can go wrong. When you have a bunch of them, there's all kinds of things that could happen, and all of those things can happen in all of those places. So it's just more dangerous. And then finally, so we've issued that report. You know, again, I don't think we expect perfection out of folks, but I hope that we can expect correction of that. We'll see what happens. Finally, on Medicaid, we've issued a lot of audits on that. That's another thing that I talked about a lot during the campaign. Privatization has been incredibly impactful in the state of Iowa, and we haven't done much to measure the impact. It is a $5 billion a year program in the state. That is more than half of the state's budget. And so we wanted to take a look at that. We've issued a few audits. I'll just give you a couple sentences on each of them. And sorry, I feel like I've been rambling on it. I do want to get to questions. We issued a data audit. We wanted to audit Health Home, which is a section of Medicaid. And instead, as we continued to attempt to draw data so that we could conduct the audit, we continued to have so many problems with the data that we could not actually conduct an audit. And so we hit the point where we just simply issued an audit that said, we have been unable to pull enough reliable data to actually issue a legitimate audit here. To use a baseball analogy, depending on the size of the strike zone you're calling, we gave the Department of Human Services we either pitched them 7 strikes or 4 strikes. Either way, they struck out. They had a lot of opportunities to pull that data and have it be pulled effectively and correctly, and they could not do it. That should be a red flag. We also issued a provider audit recently where we were looking at essentially the promises that the privatization is going to improve access and improve quality of care for people. If you're like me, fairly often you'll read a newspaper article about someone who's having a terrible time with privatized Medicaid, and your heart will go out to them and your head will wonder, is that an outlier or is that really indicative of everyone's experience? We ought to know. And so we conducted a review and audit to try to ascertain the answer to that question. What we did was we asked medical providers across the state. We did a random sample of providers that accept Medicaid patients. The reason we did that is because they have, number one, they have institutional knowledge. We only interviewed people who had conducted business under the previous system as well as under privatized Medicaid. But also they see a lot of patients. And so the idea of an outlier is going to be a little bit different to a medical provider than it would be to you or me. They will know which of their cases are outliers, and they will kind of know where the middle falls in how the system has changed. Very extensive results, but to just hit the two clearest answers, the two most impactful ones, 6% of providers, thought that privatization of Medicaid had improved access to care. 9% thought that it had improved quality of care. 9. So pretty unusual to see numbers like that. They really speak for themselves. What they say is when you read those stories are not outliers. They are evidence of a very systemic problem. The majority of providers agree that both access to care and the quality of care has gotten worse under privatized Medicaid. I'll point out that that's something that has to be hard for them to admit, because they're responsible at the end of the day for access and quality. And yet they're saying, if I'm a provider, I simply cannot do the work the way it ought to be done under this system. So again, that's not a pandemic issue, but hopefully we would see some correction from that. That's a highlight of a lot of the work that we've done, a little bit of my journey and how I got into the office and what the office is responsible for. I hope I haven't put anyone to sleep, which might be risky given the time of day. But please, you know, unmute yourself if you've got any questions. I'd love to answer them.
I have a quick question.
Go ahead, Gary.
You're a member of the executive council.
Yes.
As an outliner Democrat on the executive council, how have you found your experience and your reception there? I would be curious to see how you find your experience on the Iowa Executive Council.
Sure. Good question, Gary. You know, I can't say what that council used to be because I've only been there for 2 years, but those are the shortest meetings that I participate anywhere. I'll share a story that I heard. Mike Fitzgerald has been our treasurer for most of my life. And he was treasurer on 9/11. Tom Vilsack got the executive council on the phone all together the day after 9/11, called an emergency meeting. And if you recall, at the time, you know, people were worried about anthrax, people were worried about more attacks. We didn't know what was going to happen. And Vilsack got everyone on the call to say, hey, here's the issues that we're trying to address. Here's the things we're concerned about. I don't know, what is going to happen, but I want us all to be talking to each other and have an open line of communication. Which I think is sort of what every Iowan would expect of the executive council. You've got all these statewide elected officials. The governor's clearly the leader in that group, no doubt about that. But then everyone has a role to play and a way to serve the state. Nothing like that has happened with this pandemic. We've seen over 1,000 Iowans die, and at no point has there been outreach. In fact, I've written the governor five times, I've called numerous times, and I don't get a return letter or a return phone call when I'm trying to discuss pandemic related issues with her office. The meetings are quite perfunctory. We've had a couple of partisan line votes. They're mostly the ones that I recall off the top of my head were related to Chris Godfrey's case for discrimination against Governor Branstad in the state of Iowa, which I actually don't think was partisan. Mike Fitzgerald had drawn a line in the sand, and he had said, hey, once our expenses get above this much, I'm just not going to vote for these anymore. And so he had already been voting no prior to my arrival. I've spent too much time in court and too much time on complex cases to say that, you know, every case should be resolved at a certain point. It was a unique case. It went to the Supreme Court in Iowa twice, right? But then we had a trial, and the evidence was overwhelming. The evidence was so clear about what happened, and the jury came back very quickly with it. And so what I said is, look, you know, We had our trial as a state of Iowa. We lost. We do not need to take the risk of an appeal or pay expenses for an appeal. And so I have not been voting to pay for any appeal-related expenses. Other than that, Gary, those meetings are 5-10 minutes. There's not much discussion, just sort of yay and nay on everything. The governor's always the last one in the room. So we kind of hang around, and then I guess once we have a quorum there, somebody lets her know, and then she joins us, and we hop to it. So we have some chit-chat beforehand, but.
Rob, we've seen tons of stimulus money flood into the state of Iowa. I figure when there's a flood of money, there are all kinds of opportunities for you to be watchful and checking on things. I'm curious to know, have there been things that your office has looked into or dealt with? I'm curious, for example, about the money that came in that the governor used to pay staff. Is that a part of your portfolio?
It is. It is a part of our portfolio. And we are looking at all the CARES Act spending across the state, in addition to the data review. So our office is incredibly busy doing a lot of work that we wouldn't be doing but for the pandemic. I'll note, though, that we haven't made any requests for any of that funding the way she has been using it for her own staff. I don't think that any other statewide elected official has. And you can bet that every one of us has work that we are doing that is pandemic related. That said, the moral and ethical question of whether or not paying for our folks to do the work is a separate question from the legal one. And the legal one is really the more the one that we would answer. The way our office works is this. When we've got an investigation open, Chapter 11.42 of the code makes everything that we're doing, every piece of information we learn, confidential until we issue a report. And once, if it's in the report, then it's something that we can discuss publicly. So I can tell you we're working on it, but I can't tell you until we issue a report what we've found. So sorry to temporarily disappoint you.
Anyone else with a question?
Yes,
I have. Hey, Rob, it's Joe Rates. There was an article in Bleeding Heartland about some sort of Medicare or Medicaid that wasn't being submitted correctly, and we were being fined tremendous amounts for it, and you'd worked a deal out to get the fine reduced, and then going forward, we wouldn't have to pay anything else, and then two senators blocked that deal, and now apparently we, the taxpayers, are still on the hook for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Is that right?
Yep. That's right. I can't think of any explanation for it other than partisanship. And here's the story. Our office audits all state agencies. There's a law in the state. I want to think of how nerdy and detailed I want to make this. Look, the federal government doesn't like the way that our office is funded. We have a different source of funds for when we audit agencies that get federal funding than we do for agencies that don't get federal funding. And the federal government, which reimburses us for the costs of audits of federal funds, doesn't like us treating them differently. This is an audit that they conducted that's prior to my time in office. It's written into the law. It has nothing to do with me having shown up. They're actually looking at 2016 or 2017. And they said, hey, we don't like this. You need to not do this. And we said, well, it's written into the law, so we can't really choose to not follow the law. How about you make us a deal? If we can get the legislature to change the law, then you can just not fine the state of Iowa. And they said, okay. And we had already proposed a change to fix this, right? So this is now May when the federal government made their determination. Back in February, we had been going to the state legislature saying, hey, we think that this is a problem. One thing is that it might cause a adverse finding in a federal audit. But beyond that, it also is a system that if we change it, we will align incentives across state government. If audits will be more efficient and less expensive and take less time, and state agencies will be treated equally. These are all good things. Everybody that looked at it, that spent time with it, said, yeah, that is a good thing. We should do that. Thanks. And then we came back to this, brought back this deal, which I really, maybe I was naive. I will never quit trying though, because when you quit trying is when you can't get the result. I was really hopeful that because we had negotiated this deal that was going to save the state money, that everyone would say, oh, great. And then they would pass the law and get it changed. And, you know, we could hold each other's hands up in the air as champions for taxpayers. Hey, look, Democrats and Republicans just did you a solid, state of Iowa. Good for us. Yay for everyone. Instead, leadership in the Senate, to their credit, Michael Breitbach, who's from the Decorah area, although I don't know him, he took it up and he went to bat for it. And the leadership of the Iowa House would not take it up. Would not pass the change. I cannot, everyone that I have talked to, Democrat, Republican, Independent, who knows anything about the whole process, said, yeah, they didn't want to do it for you because you're a Democrat and you're a young Democrat and they don't want to do anything that might be good for you, which is just, to me, the epitome of why people hate politics. It's when somebody puts partisan affiliation ahead of the public. This is a no-brainer deal for the public. Even if the federal government had not come back and said, we're going to fine you if you keep doing this it this way, it still would have created a better system. And yet, like all the other proposals that we've put forward, they didn't want to do it because it came from a Democrat. Who cares? I mean, what are you getting elected for at the end of the day? Why are you in office if you're just going to sit there and not do good things for the state of Iowa because it might come from someone who has a different letter behind their name or wears a different color shirt? How pathetic. It makes me angry. I was a registered independent before I registered to vote as a Democrat. I don't like partisanship, as I'm probably making clear. That is incredibly frustrating to me because I think it shows an allegiance to partisanship rather than allegiance to the public. The state of Iowa is going to pay a fine this year because they wouldn't do it. And we're probably going to have to keep paying a fine every year until they do fix it. Childish.
Other questions?
Wanted to say I appreciate the audits you've done on the Medicaid program and also looking into how the governor spends the stimulus money. I do have a concern that you will end up in the same position that the attorney general's in, that you can't do any audit without the governor's approval. It seems like when you poke the witch, her response is, I'll get you, my pretty. Could that happen?
So the reason that the attorney general's in that position, there's a couple parts to my answer. The lawyer in me will give you the preview. It depends. There's a couple of things that got the attorney general into that position. One is the Republican trifecta, right? They control the governor's office, they control the majority in the Senate, and they control the majority in the Iowa House. What that means is no bill gets a vote unless a Republican, or no bill becomes law unless Republicans agree they want it to, and Democrats have no say in the matter whatsoever. So if Democrats flip the Iowa House this election cycle, or flip the Senate, they have to win a lot more seats to do that. But if they flip the Iowa House, then I'm not worried. Because there will be a check on bad ideas, right? What they did to Tom Miller was a bad idea. He is now the only governor the only attorney general in the entire country that can't file or participate in federal lawsuits just by exercising his or her own independent judgment. The only one out of 50. Bad idea. But Democrats wouldn't have gone along with that. I think that Democrats tend to be the party of good government. We're the ones that think that government has a role in society, if anything, right? I always like to tell people that putting Republicans in charge of it is like putting vegans in charge of the kitchen at your steakhouse. They probably don't want a lot of people to eat steaks. They probably are not going to make them taste delicious. I think if the trifecta is broken, if the Democrats win the House majority, I won't have to worry about it. Second issue, if that doesn't happen, I think there's a good likelihood that they'll come after the office just because it's currently held by a Democrat. Again, a demonstration of partisanship. I don't know if I would agree to the same sort of thing. You know, there was some brinksmanship there between the governor and the attorney general. Who knows what the governor would have done if the attorney general had not offered to enter into a gentleman's agreement or a professional agreement and understanding. Maybe it would be a better way to put that. Maybe she would have signed it. Maybe she would have vetoed it. I couldn't tell you standing right here if I would agree to that sort of a deal without knowing, you know, what exactly the change was that they were suggesting be made.
Good morning, everybody. First of all, thank you first Friday breakfast club for doing the Zoom thing. It is hard for us in rural Iowa to make the 3.5 hour trip for me personally. Even although I make it twice a week, but it's often hard to do it on a Friday. So this Zoom thing gives us that opportunity and kind of ties in what Rob was saying earlier about decentralization. Thank you, Jonathan, for your leadership, and we look forward to the next generation. Thank you, Rob Sand, for the shout out to Al-Qaeda, to the Driftless area. I particularly appreciate the Dale of Norway and Norwegian pride representation.
Yeah. That's but, right. I didn't even think about that when I was putting it on this morning, but thank you.
No, I on a personal level, I really appreciate you. For one selfish reason is that when I speak to a friend in the Northeast and in New York in particularly, because of the New York Times feature, now they know where the hell I live. So that's great. In all seriousness, I really appreciate you looking into the $26 million no-bid contract into the testing. I think it's insane. I am an immigrant to this country. I made it my own, and I.
Welcome.
Thank you. I get really emotional talking about this because I'm weirdly very protective of this country. Even during the Bush era, my whole family is overseas, and my mom is French, so I have a lot of family in France. And French people, I don't think maliciously, but like. Not maliciously, but harping on the U.S.
Sure.
And during those years, I was really, always really protective. And like, he may or may not be right, but he's the president of this country. And it pains me greatly these days that whatever they say to me now, I'm just like, you're 100% right. I have nothing to say to you.
Yeah.
These actions are criminal, and to bring it to a state level, it really pains me to see that trickle down to Iowa. I feel these are my words. I feel like Kim Reaper is after us all, and she wants to kill us all. And it is really important that you are really to be commended for the work that you are doing at that level. I guess one question that I have is, I always feel weird that whenever there is some kind of litigation, whether it's Branstad or this contract, it is, at the end of the day, it's taxpayers that are on the hook for paying these fines or outcome of lawsuits. And I'm just wondering if there is a way for like pension funds of these people to pay for it as opposed to taxpayers, because I don't think it's fair.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I've actually pushed for that to happen, particularly in the case. So there's a piece of Iowa law that says when a public employee who causes a loss to the state, when their conduct is willful and wanton, which is a higher level than normal, right? You just need a preponderance of the evidence to say, okay, the state is liable. And what this piece of law says, yeah, and if their conduct is willful and wanton, we can make them pay the state. Never in Iowa history has that piece of legislation been used. And in the case of, what's his name? The guy that was running the Iowa Finance Authority, Dave Jamieson, I said, why are we not doing this? And I voted against the settlement with him because no one would promise me that we were going to go after him. His pension expected value, depending on his life expectancy, is $1.9 million that we are going to be paying him. We are going to be paying him $1.9 million. And I cannot understand why we would do that when we could be saying, deterring him and deterring anyone else in the future from doing that kind of thing by holding them personally responsible. That is not a complicated issue. And I'm frustrated to see that we have never done that before. We put together a legal brief for why that that case should fit into that law, and nobody ever responded. The Attorney General's office, the Governor's office, we gave them a legal brief. We said, here's how this works. tell us how we're wrong. No one ever bothered to offer us anything that said otherwise.
If you're
so I'm going to keep working on that.
If you're a thank you. And if you're at liberty to share your email address, I would appreciate it if you put it in the chat area.
I will. Sure. And I should. My 6-year-old is doing virtual first grade now, about 8 feet away from me, which means I probably should log off or a little after 8 o'clock. I would welcome anyone else's questions. You can call me on the phone. My office line's 515-281-5983. And my email address is rob.sand@aos.iowa.gov.
Thank you very much.
Rob, could you give us your email address again, please?
Yeah, you bet. In fact, I see that Frederick typed it into the chat.
Okay.
Perfect. Let me type it in there, and then that way everybody can cut and paste, and we're sure that we're getting it correct.
Perfect. And also, I have a question that I will communicate to you by email to address.
If you've got one more, let's do it.
Okay. Real quickly, Iowa was set up with 99 counties and 100 county seats. They were set up so that you could get to the courthouse and home again in a horse and buggy in one day. We now can get to a county seat anywhere in the state of Iowa and back home again in one day. And I'm curious to know, given your pie effort, and if you want to give up any prospect of ever running for governor, do you see a way for your office to be a catalyst to getting us into more regional government, maybe 5 regions, for example? And I know that runs foul to people who are in these small towns, and they don't want to see their courthouse go away. And all these boards of supervisors, they don't want to go away. And and we've got some small counties with like 7 boards of supervisors and almost no population. And yeah. It's not efficient. It's not good spending money. Comment on that?
Yeah, you bet. 28E is the Iowa code chapter that allows different government entities to enter cooperative agreements to perform services. We don't have to lose our county identities. We ought to just do more 2080 agreements. So instead of each county having its own county attorney when it's not a full-time position, where you got 2 part-time county attorneys, have one that's full-time that serves 3 counties maybe. We can do it without sort of making Winneshiek and Alma Key Alma Winneshiek or something like that. So we can maintain our identity at the same time we can find efficiencies simply by saying, hey, what are we both doing that we could all just be doing together? And then you enter a 2080 agreement and you should be good to go.
Great. Okay, Rob, I want to thank you tremendously for your participation and your willingness to do it virtually. That's been great, and it's made us feel like we've really had great access to you and could hear you sort of uninterrupted. I know that you would appreciate that the LGBTQ community is not just interested in those civil rights. We're
right.
Taxpaying citizens, and we want to see government operate effectively and do a good job as well. And you have certainly demonstrated how important it is to have someone in your office who is committed to the mission of efficient, effective governance. And we deeply appreciate your role, and we wish you well in fulfilling that role and continuing to do so. With respect to the rest of you, as we know, this pandemic has its downside. It's got its frustrations. The fact of the matter is there are also opportunities. It gives us an opportunity to include Frederick in our meeting, for example. It gives us an opportunity to bring in speakers who are not close by geographically. And that, in fact, is going to be the case in November. At our meeting in November, our speaker is going to be Jane Clementi. She is the mother of Tyler Clementi and the CEO of the Tyler Clementi Foundation. Many of you will recall that Tyler Clemente was bullied online, not unlike what we see our president doing, and committed suicide. And as a result, Jane was a co-founder of the Tyler Clemente Foundation, doing work to stop the bullying and to address the bullying and to do something about it. She has agreed to be our speaker in November. The announcement will be coming out. It'll be mentioned in our newsletter. We will be also then doing it virtually. At this point, we will be doing the virtual meeting in November and probably in December, actually for the foreseeable future. Those decisions are being made in real time by the board of directors based on the science and based on the best recommendations we can get from folks like the CDC when it's trustworthy. So I want to thank you again, Rob, for your participation. I want to thank everyone who has been in on this meeting, and I want to look forward to seeing all of you again in a virtual meeting for our November meeting where we will be hearing from Jane Clemente. Thank you very much.
Thank you.